Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin leads the nation in the production of specialty cheeses, accounting for 47% of the total? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, you're listening to Why Food. This is episode number five of season four of Why Food, where we interview career changers from other industries coming into food in all of its various forms. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch.
And I'm Jenny Dorsey.
And today we're talking with Andy Jacoby, who's the co-founder of Untamed Sandwiches. They have three locations around the city, and Andy will tell us a little bit more about that. But it's great to have you here. Thanks for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
So we're going to kick off the interview with the way that we always kick off the interviews, with your aha moment. How did you know that this is what you needed to be doing? How did you know you needed to
work? That food was my, yeah. You know, so I think there have been a variety of aha moments. Probably going back to my very first aha moment was when I was probably like 4 or 5. And my parents, who are not entrepreneurial, they've never worked in food. My dad's a lawyer and my mom's worked in development, but they love food. And they've, from a very young age, they were always kind of like pushing me like out of my comfort zone, which, you know, when you're a tiny little kid, your comfort zone is very, very small. And so my dad really enjoyed like kind of pushing things on me. I remember it started with when I was like 5, and there was a neighborhood Italian restaurant that had this soup called pasta fagioli, which is a bean and pasta soup. And my dad knew that I would love this, but the name sounded really weird and I refused to try it. And he was like, no, try it. And he like stuck the spoon in my mouth and I loved it. So that was definitely my kind of first aha moment of like, experimentation in food is fun and trying new things is, you know, the spice of life. But in terms of like professionally, I think when I decided that food was right for me, you know, again, there are a number of moments. I think the kind of biggest one that I had was I had always flirted with going into food. I had flirted with the idea of transferring colleges and you know, working in or going to a hotel management program. I had flirted with actually working in restaurants after school, but I kind of kept chasing the most intense, highest paying job that I could. And eventually I think I realized that the things that were supposed to excite me when I was working in finance were not as exciting to me as they should have been. And I needed to kind of pursue my passion in food. So I took kind of what had always been an interest of mine, eating. and in particular, I've always had a fascination for meat and kind of how meat goes from an animal on a farm to your plate, and turning that into a career.
And how did braised meats, in particular braised meats in sandwiches, come about?
Yeah. The short answer to that is myself and my co-founder, this is a style of food and a style of cooking meat that we love, that he's exceptionally good at preparing as a chef and that I'm exceptionally good at eating as an eater. Also, braising is such a cool culinary or cooking process. And it's allowed us to build a really unique fast casual business, in that it is a very prep intensive process. It requires a lot of kitchen skill, but you're able to use cuts of meat that are a little bit less loved, a little bit tougher. Mm-hmm. Our thing is we focus on using, the highest quality sustainable proteins. That is very core to our concept, is how the animals lived and what they ate. But We're also trying to sell sandwiches for less than $12 or $13. And mm-hmm. so, you know, rather than offering a, you know, a grilled grass-fed grilled filet sandwich, we're able to do grass-fed beef brisket. And it allows us to keep our, keep this very high quality of food at a reasonable price point.
And as being the non-culinary quote unquote side of the business, like how did you meet your chef and how did that relationship start?
So after spending 5 years working in finance, I decided I was going to pursue my passion around food. And I didn't know what that really meant, but I just knew that I wanted to explore different things. And I had this idea to create a grass-fed beef business, to basically, you know, looking at this market that was growing and looking at the way that people were starting to really care about where their meat was coming from, that the industry was not keeping up with the demand, and that, you know, as what I considered myself to be a relatively smart business person, that there were opportunities to work with farmers and suppliers who wanted to meet this demand and kind of meet their pain points. So my idea was to kind of create a business around processing and the processing and marketing components of the business, and to work with a lot of great like-minded farmers and to build a brand around this. While I was in business school, I was working for a really great grass-fed buffalo meat business. As their director of sales and marketing, my job was to help them develop a wholesale business. And I did that for about a year while I was also in grad school. And it was a fantastic experience in that it taught me how really difficult that business was, even for this family that had a whole lot of land out in the Midwest and had a tremendous depth of knowledge about how to raise animals and, you know, a tremendous set of relationships around that business. For a novice like me, it would have been even more daunting. And so through that job, through that business, I did meet a lot of great restaurateurs and chefs and butchers and supermarket managers in New York City, one of whom became my co-founder at Untamed. So we started talking about this idea of kind of taking his style of cooking. His name is Ricky King. You know, he's from the South and has kind of a Southern style to his cooking.
Yep.
And to take his style of cooking and also his passion for kind of nose to tail cooking and to turn it into a great fast casual concept.
So yeah, tell us a little more about the concept. What kinds of sandwiches do you serve? They all have funny names. How do you come up with the names?
So the name process is fun and disjointed, and I used to say that the names that were like just dumb and fun to say were the ones that I came up with, whereas the ones that required like an encyclopedia like knowledge of food were the ones that Ricky came up with. So for example, he came up, one of our original sandwiches was a broccoli sandwich that we called the Shoemaker's Bounty, because Peter Shoemaker was this Dutch guy that first brought broccoli to England and popularized the production of broccoli, and so we called it Shoemaker's Bounty. Whereas we also have a sandwich called The Butt, because it's a cider braised pork butt sandwich, and that's one that I came up with. So
there's a nice contrast there. I like it.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of our listeners are aspirational in starting their own food business as well. So could you give some or general advice on, A, when you first came up with this concept, you said you kind of went into learning more about beef. You came about Untamed in a way that took a while. But for people who are also like, oh, I want to maybe start a restaurant or a fast casual business, what are good first steps for them to take, people to talk to, and how to... What are the like concrete things that they should be learning about in this time forward?
You know, when you start a business, especially something that is a little bit outside of your comfort zone, I'd worked in restaurants before, but I'd never taken it seriously enough. I had been a cook before. I knew how kitchens ran, or I knew how kitchens functioned. I didn't know how to run a kitchen. I didn't know how to run a restaurant. I certainly didn't know how to start one. I certainly didn't know anything about construction or all of the other tasks that go into just setting up a restaurant. And so I think what was most important for me was just to meet as many people as possible and to be very humble, but kind of, what's the word? Persistent.
Mm-hmm.
In really kind of finding people that can be helpful and can, you know, maybe be people that you might hire for certain things, but also maybe people that might be your eventual mentors or, you know, people that will be in your network. One thing that I have found that has been really nice about the restaurant industry in New York is restaurateurs are very friendly people. And I originally, when I was kind of going about doing the work and figuring out if this was something we wanted to pursue, I was shocked at how generous, incredibly successful people were with their time when I just said, hey, I've got this idea for this fast casual sandwich concept. You know, we might know, maybe we knew someone in common. Sometimes it was just me cold calling someone, and people would take 15, 20 minutes out of their day. And to this day, a lot of those people are still the people that I call on when I have questions. And therefore, I always try to pay it forward because I had that kind of generosity when I was getting started with Untamed.
And what about the funding part of it? How did you go about thinking about that, deciding which path to go on? We talked a little bit about this earlier, mm-hmm. around raising friends and family. Like, I think a lot of people are very worried about that concept of money, of asking people that they know for money for a concept that they've never worked in before.
Yeah. I think you know, with anything in business, you have to realize that what you're starting is going to be an extension of you. And therefore, it has to function with the same level of integrity as you expect to function. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that there's necessarily something inherent in asking people you know for money. In fact, it's kind of the only way to start a restaurant from the ground up. Unless you have a tremendous track record or are independently wealthy, you're probably going to be asking people to take a big chance on you.
Yep.
And you have to remember that they're investing just as much in you personally and what they think you are capable of doing as they are in the idea that you have. So I think that you have to be kind of very assertive and not shy about asking people and trust that if you are upfront about your goals, what you plan to do, risks that you know about, and then along the way, how you're going to communicate with them about the trajectory of how things are going, then, you know, if you're not successful, this is my feeling, that if you're not successful, then, you know, you've done things the right way. And you've done things in a very respectable way. And you have to trust that you're not forcing anyone to invest in you. They're making a decision, and it's a risk-adjusted decision.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as you are upfront and have high integrity, then you have to trust that people are going to make those decisions for themselves.
Speaking of family, let's change tack a little bit and talk about your family. Mm-hmm. You and your wife had a baby about 9 months ago, is mm-hmm. that right? So what's it been like being a new father, also being a fairly new business owner? Those are both huge demands on your time, on your yeah. attention, on your passion and your love. How do you balance those?
It's been a process. when we first started Untamed, my wife was actually in grad school and living outside of New York, which is probably a good thing, because I was working 22 hours a day and doing laundry once every other month. And, you know, I was a mess.
We've all been there.
So, you know, it's probably good that I didn't have really any other responsibilities or anyone to judge me too harshly for my, you know, the way I was treating myself over time. And I think this is kind of also dovetailed with the growth in the business. Like, mm-hmm. I can't do that anymore. A, because my wife would divorce me, but B, because we can't scale if I'm in the restaurant 22 hours a day.
Yep.
And so having a baby definitely accelerates your need to compartmentalize your life, sure. a little bit and delegate and really get comfortable doing that. But I think it's also been a part of the growth of Untamed, that, you know, we hire great people, we trust them to do well, and then we let them do their jobs.
So you would recommend to new business owners to have babies so that they have a...
Maybe in like year three.
Okay.
Not year one. Yeah.
And then building on that, we talked over lunch, but you've talked a lot about on your website, seems to be pretty core to your business, is the cultivation of a team culture and building a strong team where people support each other in a way that makes the business still feel like a really, you know, something that your customers have a connection to, an emotional connection to. How do you do that? That's really challenging, it's especially as you scale. Yeah.
You know, the way... There are like these two conflicting principles that people talk about in restaurants, and especially restaurants that are like trying to scale. On the one, you'll hear people say like, oh, you got to be in there all the time. You got to be watching the cameras. You got to be watching the register, because if you're not paying attention to the details, then who will be? And then on the other hand, you have people saying like, well, why are you on the register? Because if you're on the register, then you can't be doing XYZ. And I think both are true and both are not true. Like, you do have to mind the details of your business. You do have to be in the weeds. And in a way, it's a good thing to sometimes be, you know, to be touching all kinds of different parts of the business, and to understand that you have to be the one who, when things break down, it eventually flows to you. At the same time, if you're going to grow, obviously you can't clone yourself. You can't be in every place at once. And, you know, and even just saying that, that's probably not even the right way to look at it, because what's more important is that you're hiring people that are going to be able to take what you teach them in a short period of time and then get much, much better at it than you are. Also, it's important to hire people that have the same kind of values and principles that you do. And if you do that right, and you create a system where you're hiring great people, training them, and making sure that they adhere to the same principles and values that you do, then you should feel very comfortable being able to walk out the door and trust that things will go exactly the way that you expect them to go.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of small business owners, especially entrepreneurs in the early stages of a business, really struggle with, is finding one person, let alone a whole team, who you can trust to hand your business over to. So what's your interview process like? What's the vetting process like? How do you, both at the earlier stages where you were doing this yourself, but then as the business has grown, how do you make sure that you're hiring the right people? What are your tricks?
Yeah, so... Now that we're at three shops, I think one thing that's interesting is when we were at one shop, we almost like didn't need to write anything down, because it was like, especially like culture building documents, things that, you know, actually defining what is your mission? What are your principles and values? And then just at the nitty gritty of how do you do every single little thing? It's okay if when you're at one shop, if you don't have all of that figured out. And I would also say that at the beginning, it's hard to know what those things are. It's hard to actually put that down on paper because you're still kind of defining it yourself. Whereas as you grow, it's really important that you have that you kind of have everything documented so that someone can pick up, a list of your principles and values and get it. So for us, over the last year, we've created a document that we call the Untamed Way. And it sounds really cheesy, but it's what we hand every new hire the first day that they start. And it covers everything from like our mission and our principles and values to, to kind of more the way that people need to handle themselves, down to how to make a sandwich, how, you know, what the mid-shift prep list looks like, how to describe our beer and wine. How to manage customers that have particular allergy needs. Every single detail that we could think of, we tried to put into that manual, which sounds crazy and it sounds like you're boiling the ocean. But to us, we felt like we'd gotten to a point where if it wasn't down on paper, we couldn't trust ourselves as our leadership team that we were all on the same page and that we were, sharing with our new team members how we expected them to handle themselves.
I think it's so easy to, there's so many things that come intuitively to you because you're the business owner and you know everything, that you just assume people around you also know it. And then you realize if they make a mistake and they're like, oh, well, I had no idea. That's kind of like
the time where we said the impetus for actually creating what we call the Untamed Way is there's a sandwich that we call the Carla Bruni, and it has a green olive spread on it. And this olive spread, the olives that our chef uses are very strong and pungent, and it goes on one side of the bread. It cannot go on two sides of the bread. It will destroy the sandwich if it goes on two. And we had one management meeting where I was probably the one who was complaining and saying like I was in such and such shop and I saw two different people put the olive spread on two sides of the bread, and I had to correct them. Why is this happening? And like two of our senior managers were like, yeah, doesn't it go on both sides of the bread? And we're like, oh God, like we have not done a good job of actually talking about these mm-hmm. very important details. And so now I think the really gratifying thing is like even today, one of our catering coordinators took out a catering order and took a bunch of pictures of it and sent out a text to myself and our director of catering and said, like, this is the Untamed Way in catering form. And I was like, that's awesome. Nice. I'm glad that you used that in a sentence.
Why is it that sandwich called a Carla Bruni?
So this is another one that I came up with. The main ingredient in it is called ciambatta. It's an Italian vegetable stew. It's served piping hot, so it's a hot Italian sandwich. She's a hot Italian woman, so the Carla Bruni.
Obviously.
Yeah. I love it. Yeah. You shared with us one of your favorite interview questions during lunch. Could you mm-hmm. just tell us, our listeners as well?
So I think the one that you're referring to is, when we're interviewing people, hospitality is something that we focus on a lot. Even in a fast casual environment, I almost think that hospitality is a tougher thing to teach and train and make sure that you are taking care of your guests in the right way. And the reason for that is that in a full service setting, you might have 10 different touch points with a customer.
Yep.
Whereas in a fast casual setting, you have exactly two and they are very quick. So it's very important that our team really strives to use those two touch points to show the customer that they are going to do everything in their power to make their day better. And so one of the questions that I ask of people that are starting at an entry level with us is, assuming they've worked in a service business before, I say, tell me about one of your favorite customer experiences and tell me about one of your least favorite customer experiences. And the person who can answer this correctly, I find actually really, especially for the one that when they're describing one of their favorite customer experiences, they can do it with very little thought. They might struggle to remember the person's name. They might, some of the details might be fuzzy, but like a smile will come over their face as they describe, that customer, that regular, or, that person who started off having a difficult experience, but, I recognized that what they really wanted was X, and by the end, we were swapping stories about such and such. Like those kinds of stories come so naturally to people that what Danny Meyer describes as the 51 percenters. Like if you come in with a desire to take care of people, to make people's day a little bit better, then that gets you 51% of the way there.
Yep.
And you can train for the rest. And that question is kind of designed to figure out if we're talking to a 51% or not.
It's hard to gauge attitude, I think. That's like the people want to come in, or some people want to come in and do their job and then get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find the people who really want to care about, like, you. It's your brand, it's your business, and it's, who people are going to see of you at the end of the day, too.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to think about why people are choosing to work at Untamed as opposed to someplace else.
Mm-hmm.
And I always think that the people that are really great restaurant professionals are, they're smart enough, they're hardworking enough that they could be doing something far easier that is far more lucrative. And so there's something about working in a restaurant that drives that person. And if you're not creating the kind of environment where they're going to feel satisfied and they're going to feel like, you know, you're appreciative of that and you're letting them do their thing as hospitality professionals, then why are they even there?
Yeah. So can we put you on the spot? Can we ask you your own interview question? What are your favorite and least favorite customer interactions?
My favorite, it has been a while since I've been like positioned behind the register where I really do remember a lot of our customers. But I was saying before, one of my favorite customers at our original Bryant Park shop was this. It was actually a husband, wife, and their daughter who all operated a family business together, and their office was right next door to us. And the mom and daughter used to come in all the time together, and they both loved our chili and they would get the same thing. And they were just super sweet people. The sad thing is I remember there was like a week long period where it was just the daughter coming in, and I thought like, oh, what's, you know, did we mess up the chili last week or something? Like, where's Adams, who was the name of the mom? Her daughter told me that she had passed away, which was very sad. But I guess, you know, the fact that we've been around for 4 years and we have amazing regulars who may have passed away is also, you know, a thing that says like, you know, we've actually like, you know, seen a decent chunk of some people's lives, which mm-hmm. is nice. And my least favorite, I think, is you know, any time where I feel like where we've just obviously messed up or I've obviously messed up for no good reason. That pisses me off. Like, we actually, this is something that's sticking out to me right now. This probably happened like 6 months ago. We had a buyout at one of our shops, and whenever we do buyouts, buyouts at a fast casual restaurant are kind of weird because
what's a buyout?
Buyout is when someone plans a private event at your restaurant. And you know, we put up all kinds of signage. We try to let people know like it closed for a private event, but some people will inevitably walk in and come up to the register and order a sandwich, or try to order a sandwich. And this woman comes up, and the other thing is, because of just the way our stores are laid out, you don't know if someone is part of the party or if someone just missed the sign when they walk in. So this woman walks in, and she's asking me like all kinds of questions about our menu, and she's like super excited about it. And I assume that she was a guest. I was a guest of the person who was hosting the party. And then when we finish up, she goes to hand me money, and I realize like, oh crap, like this is someone who actually thinks we're open. And I kind of like, I like flubbed it. I like half-assed it. I was like, oh, we're closed for a private event, but I really want to get you a sandwich. Would you mind taking it to go? She was like, no, I live far away from here. I was just here for work. I need you here. I was like, oh, can you stand in the corner? Can you like kind of pretend you're not here? And I was, you know, I was rude. I just did not handle it well. What I should have done was I should have probably handed her a gift card when I realized that she wasn't with the party, and I should have said like, I'm so excited that you're so excited to be here, but I can't take care of you the way that I want to right now. So mm-hmm. here's a gift card. Please come back another time. Instead, I screwed this up. And what's funny is I blatantly screwed it up, and I totally deserved this. She wrote us a nasty email saying, your jerk of a cashier like told me to stand in the corner and eat my sandwich. And I got that email and I responded very quickly, and I was like, I'm so sorry. So yeah, those are the worst customer moments are the ones where I think, you know, we had an opportunity to make someone super happy, and maybe we blew that opportunity.
I think that's so telling, though, right? That your least favorite customer experience was not one where the customer was a jerk or the customer behaved badly, but one where you felt like you didn't, I don't know, step up in the way that you could. And I've heard that sort of similar stories from other entrepreneurs who are often pretty hard on themselves. And it's never about being mad at your customer as much as it is being mad at yourself for not handling a situation.
Yeah. The way that high expectations.
Yeah. I mean, exactly.
You know, it's our job to, again, to make every customer's day a little bit better. And in some cases that's super easy, and in some cases it's harder. And you can't look at a you know, someone who is harder as a problem or a bad thing in and of itself. It's a challenge, you know, and not everyone's going to walk out of Untamed thinking they had a fantastic experience. But that's what we have to strive for.
Yeah. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious, stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back. Today we're here with Andy Jacoby, the co-founder of Untamed Sandwiches, and we were just talking about good and bad customer experiences and building team culture. But I think I'm going to transition a little bit over to the fact that now Untamed has grown to 3 locations in 2 different boroughs of New York. How did you know it was the right time to expand, and how was that process?
So it took us a long time to actually go from 1 to 2. We opened up our first, actually this week is our 4th year anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
Of opening our initial shop. Thank you. But it took us, we only opened up our second one about a year ago. And in my mind, it wasn't that we weren't ready. We were really trying to grow to a second location. The real estate market was so hot at the time that we just had a lot of things fall through, and you know, it was very hard to find a deal that I thought was going to be right for us. And so it took us a very long time to go from 1 to 2, and then a relatively short period of time to go from 2 to 3, because we found 2 places that we were excited about. But I think that even going from 1 to 2 is really, really hard, because you're, you know, again, a lot of what we were talking about before about not having your everything committed to paper, you know, committed to like really strong processes, makes going from 1 to 2 a challenge. And, you know, in hindsight, we probably should have been a little bit more process driven before we opened up our second shop. But also just from a team perspective, it's hard when you're one small restaurant. It's tough to afford, you know, to have a deep bench of great managers and great leaders, such that you could just take half of them and move them to another location and expect that everything is gonna go the right way. And for us, we've always really focused on trying to grow our own leaders in-house. Every single general manager on our team now is someone who started at a lower level, and that's a really important part of the culture. So going from 1 to 2 was really challenging. We didn't have the bench of leadership to be able to do it easily, and I don't think that we opened in the best way possible as a result. I don't think we were as sharp as we should have been, whereas I think going from 2 to 3, you've done it before. You've got a bigger team at that point. You've got people who are kind of seeing that you're growing and are willing to wait in the wings a little bit and wait for their opportunity.
one of the things we talked about years ago when you were just thinking about growing to from one to two was if you should adopt a commissary model that many other fast casual places, including one that I used to work at, has adopted. Could you tell us a little bit about that decision process?
Sure. So it was building a commissary was actually always part of our plan. And the reason is what I think defines a concept that works well with a commissary versus one that doesn't is how prep intensive is your concept, how service intensive is your concept. The ones that lend themselves best to a commissary model are the ones that are very prep intensive and very service light. For us, all of our meats go through a 5-day braising process, and braising is a very technical technical process, and it is the core of what we do. So our executive chef with our commissary model can be in one place overseeing the most important part of what we do. But also, it's not that much harder for him to braise 300 pounds of meat at a time than it is to braise 50 pounds of meat at a time. And so as a result, the kind of scalability of a concept works really well for us. And therefore, at the end of those 5 days, you know, we've got a braise that's fully cooked, has been cooled down to a holding temperature, can be sent to one of our shops, brought back up to 140 degrees and served. And that process for us today in our, like, quote, satellite locations, the ones that are not directly connected to the commissary, is actually no different than the way that we would use those 5 days to braise and then, you know, cool down meats and bring them back up to temp when we had one shop. Mm-hmm. And so for us, there was never a concern about maintaining quality. There was never a concern about how complicated the service of our product was. We knew that the prep was complicated, and that's what kind of lent itself very well to a commissary model.
And a commissary model is one where you're producing a lot of the food offsite and then transporting it
to the
restaurants themselves. So it does add this level of logistical complexity, right? Deliveries, moving things around, keeping track of how many of Carla Brunis you're selling at a particular location. How do you track all of that?
We've gotten more sophisticated about it over time.
Does that mean you weren't?
We were not at the beginning. But also at the beginning, you know, our shop in Brooklyn is much smaller than our shop than our original shop in Bryant Park, and now smaller than our third shop, and we knew that was going to be the case. So it was kind of like, yeah, we're preparing all this food in Brooklyn to send it to Manhattan, but now that we've got two places that are our biggest and second biggest restaurants. That are being where the food's being transported there. We do really have to focus a lot more on logistics and maintaining really good inventory and understanding our numbers a little bit better. And I think, you know, my partner, our chef, comes from a fine dining background where, you know, he's kind of very used to seeing the food, touching the food, being able to walk into the walk-in every day and kind of understand exactly what he had to work with. And so I don't, even he's had to teach himself kind of how to manage from afar and manage through people that, by the way, do not have culinary backgrounds. Mm-hmm. So in our shops, there's one general manager who is responsible for everything that happens within those four walls. Every customer that walks in, every member of their team, every, ounce of food that is served is the responsibility of that general manager. Our chef has to work very closely with our managers to make sure that we know what's being served every day, what needs to be transported to the shops.
One of the words that you mentioned over lunch that I just thought of, I think a lot of people, myself included, is imposter syndrome and dealing with that as you've expanded and your Untamed is doing great, but still struggling with that sometimes as you watch other colleagues do their own thing. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey?
I don't know if imposter syndrome ever goes away. And I think the person that thinks like, no, I'm exact. I deserve this. I'm right where I should be.
Crushing it.
Is probably someone that's not capable of growing and learning. And I think part of the reason that you push yourself to learn is the fear that, like, you will be found out that you don't actually know what you're doing. So I constantly have that fear. I constantly think, like, I can't believe that we have not figured this out. I look at, you know, our competitor or my buddy across the street, and, like, I know that they're not dealing with this problem. What the hell is wrong with us? What the hell is wrong with me? And I think if I took a step back, I would probably realize that a lot of the same problems that we face are probably things that others face too. It's a very hard business. And again, going back to what we said at the beginning about just, like, the network of amazing restaurant people in New York, it's essential to our success that I have so many amazing restaurateurs that I can reach out to and say, hey, we're dealing with this problem. Can you guys help me? And actually, the hardest thing for me has been to kind of have the humility to admit to others. I can admit it to our team. Like, I'm very comfortable having a very open dialogue with our leadership team and kind of everyone on our team about how we're doing, what needs to improve, what you know, we need to keep doing the same. But it's oftentimes very hard for me to admit to a peer, like, we're really struggling with XYZ and can you help? But the more I do that, the more I learn that I know some great people who can help me out if I just am willing to ask.
And that's so important, right? Like, the ability to say, to admit, I don't know how to do this. Let me talk to somebody who does, somebody else who solved this problem. Yeah, I mean, my business is only a year old and not near where yours is in terms of success or growth. But yeah, like, starting knowing nothing and having to figure it all out and not knowing whether the wonky way that you figured it out is actually, if anybody else is doing it that way, there's got to be a better way to do whatever it is that you're trying to do.
And there probably is, right?
I hope there is.
You know, there probably is. And in a way, you got to say, I should try to figure out the best way, like, to reasonably do this. But it's also okay that I make some reasonable mistakes along the way.
Yeah.
And there isn't necessarily one right way to do everything.
Yeah, wow. That's so much of entrepreneurship, right? Like, this is the way that works for today, even if it's not the way that's going to work long term, even if it's not the best way overall, but this is what I'm doing,
right. So yeah.
I'm doing it.
Right.
I just had a fun experience with that where I got burned pretty badly by a contractor, which we were also talking about earlier. I won't even go into details, but I was so upset because I got burned last year by a contractor in a similar situation. And my husband just said, you know, you're just learning to how to fire people. So that's just something you got to learn a few times over.
In the last few minutes of the podcast, we're going to transition to a new segment. So Andy, you get to be our guinea pig on this. We're going to do, starting this week, do a sort of a rapid fire, kind of more personal, funny questions that we're going to ask every guest. Some of the questions will be the same every week. Some of them will be different. If any of our listeners have suggestions for goofy, quick questions, please
send them
on Instagram or via the website. But so, Andy, we're going to start with, what should we start with, Jenny?
What were you eating lunch as, when you were a kid?
Yeah. What was your, like, go-to lunch as a kid? What did your parents pack you or in school?
So I was always the kid that I think, I've always really liked variety. I was probably always the kid that envied the kid next to me and what they got. So I would usually start with whatever I had, and then I would trade as many times as I could.
Oh.
So I think I would, my parents.
So entrepreneurial.
I know, right? I think my parents were big into cold cuts, but I grew up in some decently diverse places. And so, you know, I would be in school with kids that had some very different things and got to try some cool things.
Ethan, nice. What were you eating as a kid?
I ate for lunch as a kid. I grew up in New York City. I ate school lunch a lot. My father would make me peanut butter and jelly sandwich. I don't know, nothing super exciting.
I think my parents, it was an age where everyone thought turkey was just the only thing you should eat.
Oh, yeah,
but it was
yeah,
like
yeah.
the leanest protein and it was super healthy.
Jenny, what was your childhood lunch like?
Well, mostly my mom would pack me lunch. She liked to like leftovers and stuff. I had a little thermos. I also had a rolly backpack and glasses that had the string, so I was really popular in school, as you can probably imagine. But my favorite school lunch was chicken tenders and mashed potatoes with gravy. And sometimes, if I was really nice to the lunch guy, he would give me an extra chicken tender. Yes.
Smart.
Nice. Next question. Spirit animal. What's your spirit animal?
I think I would be a bear because I'm bigger than I should be, and I'm kind of hairy. But also, I just kind of trudge along on a path, and I'm harder to push around than I think people think.
But you're also soft and cuddly.
But I'm kind of soft and cuddly.
If you had to pick a spirit cut of meat, what would it be?
Spirit cut of meat.
I'm talking.
I think the brisket would be my spirit cut of meat because it's very versatile and people don't. Not everyone understands how many different parts of the brisket there are and how many different things you can do with it.
Very insightful. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. How do you like your eggs?
In a sandwich, but I'll go further. I love runny yolks, so I know that that's like a Instagram trend now or whatever, but I love sandwiches where you have an egg over easy and the yolk kind of just soaks into whatever else is in the sandwich and makes it rich and delicious.
I wish you could see Andy's face right now. He just like looks so hungry.
Thinking.
We just had awesome
pizza.
What's the best meal you've ever had that cost less than $10?
Oh man, that's...
That was not made in one of your restaurants?
Ooh, that is a really tough question. Mm. I'm trying to think. I remember actually, this is a good one. There are too many good meals that I've had. Most of the meals I have these days are for like around $10 or less. I eat a lot of fast casual food. But
just market research, right?
Always, always. That's why I have four lunches a day. I went to Vietnam, and I remember some of the street carts there. You would find food for an unbelievably cheap price. You had to be careful because there are lots of street carts. We were in Hanoi, and. You know, you could also walk into a place where you weren't quite sure if you're going to feel so good the next day. You know, you could find some amazing kind of local delicacies.
What stands out? What do you remember?
I remember some of the noodle and beef dishes that we had. I wouldn't even start to be able to pronounce the names. And the funny thing about being in Hanoi is like they don't give a crap about the fact that you're American or whether you speak English. Like they're just going to talk to you in talk to you in Vietnamese until you say something that they can understand. And so there's just a lot of pointing. So I to this day have no idea what I was eating. I think it was beef, but there were some really good beef noodle dishes. I remember.
Nice.
Speaking of fast casual joints, where is your go-to fast casual place? Obviously, that Untamed can't be the choice when you're getting a quick bite in the city.
I have so many. Really depends. I still get like I get excited when I pass by certain fast casual places. So like I eat a lot of Dos Toros. I eat a lot of Luke's Lobster. I eat a lot of. I think I might be mispronouncing this, but Jian's Famous Foods.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's really good. I don't even know. There's so many. There's so many good ones. I love Carilla. I love Melt Shop. I ate a lot of sandwiches. So, yeah.
I guess our last question, if you could master a skill overnight, what would that skill be?
Master a skill.
It doesn't have to be a skill that's like, you know, like learning the keyboard. It can be like reading minds.
Sure.
I would love to be able to fly. Is that like, I know.
Sure, superpower or whatever.
Oh, wait,
real skill, like something that I actually hope to be able to achieve, I would love to actually have a better memory for everything. I get accused by my team all the time of repeating myself, and I probably do. Once upon a time, I thought I had a good memory, but then, people on my team love to point out either A, when I repeat myself, or B, when I totally contradict myself, like from, you know, 1 week to the next, I'll say like, why are we doing things this way, guys? Like this is a terribly broken process. Like, you told us to create this process last week. Like, oh, I did? Oh. So, yeah. Better memory.
My girlfriend was giving me a hard time last night because I was talking through some aspect of my business and she stops me and she goes, you know, you're explaining your business to me for the 100th time this week. Like, I know how your business works. I was like, yeah, but right. But something about that process of repeating it or to having the same conversation, I don't know what it is. But
being the spouse of an entrepreneur is probably harder than being an entrepreneur yourself.
Yeah.
Support group.
My wife has to pretend she's interested when I'm explaining all the things that I'm explaining for the fifth time.
Right, right. Oh, exactly. Yeah. Andy, this has been so awesome. Thanks for joining us.
It's just
been such a pleasure to have you on the show. We'll be interviewing Jeremy Lyman of Birch Coffee next week. So tune in next week for that interview.
If you have more questions for Andy, please reach out to us on our Instagram or send us an email, whyfood@heritageradio.org. And also, Andy, can you tell all the listeners where to find you as well?
Sure. So Untamed Sandwiches, we have 3 shops in Dumbo, just south of Bryant Park, and in Midtown East. We're on Instagram at Untamed Sandwiches, Twitter at Untamed Sandwich, untamedsandwiches.com. Anything else?
And what about getting in touch with you personally if people want to take you up on your offer to share advice or
absolutely. My email is andy@untamedsandwiches.com.
Nice. Awesome. Well, thank you. And we also have our Red Crickets to thank for our wonderful theme song, which is named Blind.
And our amazing producer, Vitor Hirsch. Tune in next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Well, that's history of mine.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.